strangers. Alice was slim. She could move with great elegance. She was not beautiful. She would never be that, nor pretty, nor conventionally attractive. But she could embody an intense sexuality. Malcolm knew that. She let it show now, just to disconcert them. The master went behind his desk and sat down, making a meaningless remark about the weather. Still, Alice hadn't said a word. "Mrs. Lonsdale," Hammond said, having settled himself. "These two gentlemen are from a government agency concerned with matters of security. They have a few questions to ask, and I thought it would be better all round for the college if it happened quietly here, in my presence. I hope everything is well with you."
"Mr. Corson told me you were seeing all the servants. He said it was just an internal matter, domestic. He obviously didn't know about these two policemen."
"I'm not policemen, Mrs. Lonsdale. Civil servants, perhaps. And, as I say, I thought it best to maintain a certain discretion."
"In case I wouldn't come if I heard they were here?"
"Oh, I'm sure you know where your duty lies, Mrs. Lonsdale. Mr. Manton, would you like to begin?"
The older of the two men was sitting on Alice's left. She looked at him just once, and saw a blandly good-looking face, a neat grey suit, and a striped tie, and the body of a man too interested in weightlifting. His demon was a wolf.
"Mrs. Lonsdale," he said. "My name is Captain Manton. I..."
"No, it isn't," she said. "Captain isn't a name, it's a rank. Captain in what, anyway? You look like a secret policeman, is that what you are?"
As she spoke to him, she looked directly at the master. He returned her gaze with no expression at all.
"We don't have secret police in this country, Mrs. Lonsdale," the man replied. "Captain is my rank, as you observe. I'm an officer in the regular army, seconded for security duties. My colleague here is Sergeant Topham. We're interested in a young woman, you know. Lyra Belacqua."
"Belacqua's not her name."
"I believe she goes by the nickname Silvertongue, but legally, that is not her name."
"Where is she, Mrs. Lonsdale?"
"Fuck off," said Alice calmly. Her eyes were still on the master's face, and his expression hadn't changed in the slightest. However, a delicate pink was beginning to show in his cheeks.
"That attitude isn't going to help you," said Manton.
"At this moment in time, in this informal setting, it's just bad manners.
But I should warn you."
The door opened, and Janet came in with the tray.
"Thank you, Janet," the master said. "Just leave it on the desk, if you would."
Janet couldn't help looking at Alice, whose gaze was still fixed on the master. Alice said to the agent,
"Yes?
You were going to warn me about something." A tiny frown appeared on Hammond's forehead, and he glanced at Janet.
"Just leave the tray," he said.
"I'm still waiting," said Alice. "Someone was going to warn me about something."
Janet put the tray down. Her hands were shaking. She crossed to the door, almost tiptoeing, and went out.
Hammond sat forward and began to pour the coffee.
"That really wasn't very wise, Mrs. Lonsdale," said Manton.
"I thought it was quite clever."
"You're putting your friend in danger."
"I don't know how you work that out. Am I in danger?"
The master passed one cup to Manton, another to his colleague.
"I think it would really help, Mrs. Lonsdale," he said, "if you simply answered the questions."
"Alice? May I call you Alice?" said Manton.
"No."
"Very well. Mrs. Lonsdale, we're concerned about the well-being of the young lady, who used to be in your care at Jordan College, Lyra Belacqua." He said the name firmly.
Alice said nothing. Hammond was now watching narrow-eyed.
"Where is she?"
said the other man, Topham. It was the first time he'd spoken.
"I don't know," said Alice.
"Are you in contact with her?"
"No."
"Did you know where she was going when she left?"
"No."
"When did you last see her?"
"A month ago. I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks. You're from the CCD, aren't you?"
"That's neither here nor—"
"I bet you are,"
I asked that because some of your thugs came here, came to this college, to a room, the last day I saw her. Got themselves let into a place that ought to have been safe. Made a right mess of it. So you'll have a record of that date. That's when I last knew where she was. As far as I know, you might have taken her yourself since then. She might be locked up in one of your filthy dungeons right now. Have you looked?
She was still staring at Hammond. The pink had left his cheeks, which were now becoming pale.
"I believe you know more than you're telling us, Mrs. Lonsdale," said Manton.
"Oh, is that what you believe? And is it true because you believe it?"
"I think you know more than... You answer my question, and I might answer yours."
"I'm not playing a game, Mrs. Lonsdale.
I have the authority to ask questions, and if you don't answer them, I'll arrest you."
"I thought a place like Jordan College was safe from this sort of bullying interference. Was I wrong, Dr. Hammond?"
"There used to be a concept known as scholastic sanctuary," said the master, "but that's long out of date. In any case, it only offered protection to scholars. College servants have to answer questions here just as they do outside. I really advise you to answer, Mrs. Lonsdale."
"Why?"
"Cooperate with these gentlemen, and the college will make sure you have legal representation. But if you adopt an attitude of truculent hostility, there's little I can do to help."
"Truculent hostility," she said. "I like the sound of that."
"I'll ask you again, Mrs. Lonsdale," said Manton. "Where is Lyra Belacqua?"
"I don't know where she is. She's travelling."
"Where is she going?"
"Dunno. She never told me."
"Well, you see, that's one thing I don't believe. You're very close to that young woman. Known her all her life, so I understand. I don't believe she'd just take off on a whim and never tell you where she was going."
"On a whim? She left because your thugs were chasing her. She was afraid, and I don't blame her. There used to be a time when there was justice in this country. I don't know if you remember it, Dr. Hammond. Maybe you were somewhere else. But in my lifetime, it used to be that you had to have cause to arrest someone. And what did you call it? Truculent hostility wasn't cause enough."
"But that's not what the problem is," said Manton. "You can be as truculent as you like. It makes no difference to me. I'm not interested. If I arrest you, it won't be because of your emotional attitude, but because you refuse to answer a question. I'll ask you again."
"I've answered it. I've told you. I don't know where she is."
"And I don't believe you."
"I think you do. And I'm going to make damn sure you tell me." "And how are you going to make damn sure? You're going to lock me up?
Torture me? What?"
Manton laughed. Topham said, "I don't know what lurid stories you've been reading, but we don't torture people in this country."
"Is that true?"
Alice asked Hammond.
"Of course. A torture is forbidden under English law."
Before any of them could react, Alice stood up and went swiftly to the door. Ben, her demon, usually self-contained and even languid, was quite capable of ferocity. And he snarled and snapped at the demons of the two CCD men to keep them back while Alice opened the door and went out into Janet's office. Janet looked up from her desk in alarm. The bursar, Mr. Stringer, had arrived and was standing beside her sorting through some letters. Alice had time to say, "Janet, Mr. Stringer, witnesses," before Topham caught hold of her left arm. Janet said,
"Alice, what?"
The bursar stared in astonishment, and his demon fluttered up from one shoulder to the other. A moment later, Alice swung her right hand round and slapped Topham's face hard. Janet gasped. Ben and the other two demons were snarling, biting, grappling, and Topham kept a tight grip on Alice's arm and then spun around and slammed the arm up behind her back.
"Tell people," Alice cried. "Tell the whole college. Tell people outside. I'm being arrested for..."
"That's enough," said Manton, who had come to join Topham and who now took hold of Alice's other arm in spite of her struggles.
"This is what happens now in this college," Alice said. "Under that man, this is what he allows. This is the way he likes to..."
Manton shouted to drown her voice. "Alice Lonsdale, I'm arresting you for obstructing an officer in the performance of his duty."
"They're trying to find Lyra," Alice shouted. "That's who they really want. Tell everyone."
She felt her arms pulled backwards and tried to go with it, but then the click of a lock and a hard metal edge digging into her wrist told her she was pinioned. She fell still. No point in fighting handcuffs.
"Dr. Hammond, I must protest,"
the bursar began as the master came out of the inner office. Topham had slipped a chain around Ben's neck, attached to a long, stout stick wrapped in leather. It was humiliating for the demon, and he fought furiously, snarling and tearing and snapping. Topham was good at this, trained, practiced, and ruthless. Ben had to submit. Alice knew, though, that Topham would have a hard time when he tried to take the chain off. Hammond said to the bursar,
"Raymond, this is sad and quite unnecessary business. I do beg your pardon. I was quite clearly wrong to think we could deal with it tactfully. But why is it necessary to use this degree of force? I'm absolutely appalled, Master. Mrs. Lonsdale is a college servant of long standing."
"These men are ordinary police, Mr. Stringer," Alice said. "They're..." "Take her outside," said Manton. Topham began to pull, and she resisted. "Tell people!" Alice shouted. "Tell everyone you know! Janet, tell Norman and Barry!" Topham pulled so hard she lost her footing and fell on the floor. Ben plunged and snarled and fought at the end of the chain, his teeth snapping an inch from Manton's throat.
"Raymond, step inside with me for a moment,"
were the last words Alice heard from the master, as she saw him put his arm around the bursar's shoulders and draw him into the inner office. The last thing she saw was Janet's terrified face, and then she felt the prick of a sharp needle in her shoulder, and she lost consciousness. Quite early that afternoon, as soon as Janet, the bursar's secretary, could get away, she cycled hard up the Woodstock Road toward the Wolvercote Turn. Her squirrel demon Axel sat in the basket on the handlebars, cold and fearful. Janet had often been to the Trout with Alice and other friends. She knew at once what Alice's last words meant. Norman and Barry were the two peacocks at the inn. The original Norman and Barry had drowned in the Great Flood, but their successors always bore the same names, because Malcolm's mother said it saved time. She pedalled hard through Wolvercote and along to Godstow, and turned in at the garden of the Trout, hot and breathless.
"Your hair is all over the place," said Axel. "Oh, for goodness sake, stop fussing."
She smoothed it down and went into the parlour. It was a quiet time of day. There were only two drinkers in the bar, gossiping by the fire. Mrs. Polstead was polishing glasses and smiled a welcome.
"Don't usually see you at this time of day," she said. "Afternoon off."
"I need to tell you something urgent,"
Janet said in her quietest voice. The drinkers by the fire took no notice. Mrs. Polstead said,
"Come into the terrace room,"
and led the way along the corridor. The two demons, Squirrel and Badger, followed them close behind. As soon as the door was closed, Janet said,
"Alice Lonsdale, she's been arrested."
"What?" Janet told her what had happened.
"And she said, as they took her away, she said to me, 'Tell Norman and Barry.' And, of course, I knew she didn't mean the peacocks. I knew she meant you and Reg. I don't know what to do. Oh, it was awful."
"CCD, you think?"
"Oh, yes, no doubt at all."
"And the master didn't do anything to stop it?"
"He was on their side. He was helping them. Oh, but it's all round college now, obviously, about Alice, and everyone's furious, like they were when he took Lyra's rooms away, and then when she vanished. But there's nothing you can do, is there? He hasn't broken any laws. It's quite within his power. Oh, but poor Alice. Good for her, though. She got in a good slap on one of those thugs."
"Oh, I imagine she would. You wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of Alice. But the bursar, though, what did he say?"
"After he came out of the office with the master, he was, I don't know how to put it, subdued. Not himself. Ashamed, even. It's a horrible place now, Jordan,"
Janet finished passionately.
"It wants clearing out," said Brenda.
"Why don't you come with me?"
"Where?" "Jericho. I'll tell you why on the way."
The two women cycled together, urgently, along the towpath through Port Meadow, down to the boatyard, over the footbridge, and along Walton Well Road and into Jericho. Malcolm's mother had known Hannah Relf almost as long as he had, and knew she'd want to know at once about this. Brenda Polstead had a shrewd idea about the secret hinterland her son shared with Dame Hannah, although she'd never asked either of them about it. She knew Hannah would know the right people to talk to, who'd be able to help, who else to warn. They turned into Cranham Street, but stopped at once.
"That's her house," said Brenda.
Outside Hannah's house stood an Anbarrick van, and a man was putting several boxes in the back. They watched as he came out twice, each time with an armful of cardboard boxes or files.
"That's one of the men from this morning," Janet whispered.
They pushed their bicycles along the pavement towards the van.
As Topham came out with a third armful of files, he turned and saw them. He glared at them, but said nothing, and shut the van before going back inside.
"Come on," said Brenda.
"What are we going to do?"
"We're just going to call on Hannah. Perfectly normal thing to do." Janet followed as Brenda pushed her bike forthrightly up to the house and leaned it on the little garden wall. Brenda's badger demon, broad-snouted, heavy-shouldered, was close at her heels as she rang the doorbell. Janet waited a few feet further back. There were voices inside, male voices, and Hannah's too. Theirs were raised, and hers wasn't. Brenda rang the doorbell again. She looked at Janet, who looked back at this stocky woman in her 50s, in her tweed overcoat that was a little too tight, and with her expression of calm determination. Janet saw Malcolm very clearly in his mother at that moment, and she had admired him greatly and silently for a long time. The door opened, and Brenda turned back to face the other man, the one who was in charge.
"Yes," he said cold and hard.
"Well, who are you then?" said Brenda. "We've come to visit my friend Hannah. Are you doing some work for her?"
"She's busy at the moment. You'll have to come back later."
"No, she'll see me now. She's expecting me. Hannah," she called, loud and clear. "It's Brenda. Can I come in?"
"Brenda!"
Hannah called, and her voice sounded tight and high-pitched, and then was cut off.
"What's going on?" said Brenda to the captain.
"It's absolutely nothing to do with you. Dame Ralph is helping us with some important inquiries. I'm going to ask you to..."
"Dame Ralph?" said Brenda with powerful scorn. "Get out of the way, you ignorant bully. Hannah, we're coming in!"
Before the man's demon could do more than snarl, Brenda's badger had the wolf's paw in his crushing jaws and was shouldering her out of the way. The captain put his hands on Brenda's breast and tried to push her back, but she swung her right hand and cracked him so hard on the side of the head that he stumbled and nearly fell.
"Topham!" he called.
Brenda was past him already, and at the sitting room door. She saw Hannah inside, sitting upright and uncomfortable as the other man twisted her arm behind her back.
"What do you think you're doing?" Brenda said.
Behind her she could hear a scuffle, and Janet said loudly,
"Don't you touch me!"
Hannah said, "Brenda, be careful." Topham twisted her arm further, and Hannah grimaced.
"Let her go at once," Brenda demanded. "Take your hands off. Stand back. Move right away. Go on."
Topham's reply was to twist even harder. Hannah couldn't help a little gasp of pain. Suddenly, something cannoned into Brenda's back, and she fell forward into the little room, right over the chair Hannah was sitting in. Janet fell with her. Manton had flung her forward to shake her hands off his sleeves, and all three women tumbled onto the hearth, just a forearm's length away from the fire. Topham had lost his grip on Hannah's arm, and under the impact of the other two he fell back against the glass cabinet that held Hannah's collection of porcelain, crashing with it to the floor. Brenda was the first to stand up, and in her hand was the poker from the little stand of fire irons. Janet, in imitation, had picked up the shovel. Hannah had fallen badly and didn't seem able to move, but Brenda stepped across her and confronted the two men implacably.
"Now, turn around, go outside, and leave," she said. "You're not getting any further with this. I don't know who you think you are or what you think you're doing, but by God, you're not going to get away with it."
"Put that down," said Manton to Brenda. "I warn you."
He tried to seize it. She swiped him hard across the wrist and he took a step backwards. Topham was still struggling to get up from the broken frame and shattered glass of the cabinet. Brenda glanced at him and was pleased to see him bleeding from a cut hand.
"And you," Brenda said, "how dare you manhandle an elderly woman, you cowardly thug! Go on, get out!"
"All those boxes," said Janet.
"Yes, stealing as well. You can take them out of your van before you go."
"I remember you," said Manton to Janet. "You're the secretary from Jordan College. You can say goodbye to that job."
"And what have you done with Alice Lonsdale?" Brenda said. "Where have you taken her? What's she supposed to have done?"
Janet was trembling with shock, but Brenda seemed to have no fear, confronting the two CCD men as if all the moral power in the situation belonged to her, which it did.
"You seem to be unaware that we have authority to carry out investigations," Manton began. But Brenda's voice overwhelmed his.
"No, you haven't, you thief! You
coward, you thug! No one has the authority to come into anyone's house without a warrant. You know that, and I know that. Everyone knows it. Nor do you have the authority to arrest people without a cause. Why did you arrest Alice Lonsdale? Nothing to do with... It's got everything to do with me. I've known that woman since she was a child. There's not a criminal bone in her body. And she's been a first-rate servant to Jordan College, too. What did you do to the master to make him give her up? That's got nothing. You can't give me a reason because there isn't one, you wretch. You bully, you sneaking villain. What have you done with her? Tell me!
Janet was helping Hannah get up. The sleeve of the old woman's cardigan was scorched, even burnt. She had actually fallen on the fire for a moment, but hadn't uttered a sound. Burning pieces of coal were beginning to scorch the hearthrug, and Janet bent to scoop them up quickly with a shovel. Meanwhile, Topham was picking a piece of glass out of his hand, and Manton was turning away from Brenda's fierce demand.
"Come on," he said to the sergeant. "You're not giving up," said Topham. "Waste of time. Outside, now."
"We'll find her," said Brenda. "We'll have her out of your custody, you lawless vermin. The day'll come when the bloody CCD are drummed right out of this country with your tails between your legs."
"We ain't," began Topham, but Manton said, "Enough, Sergeant, that's enough. On our way."
"Captain, we could take her."
"Not worth the trouble." "We know you," he said, looking at Janet. "And we'll have you before long," he went on, looking at Hannah. "And we'll find out who you are, easy enough. And you'll be in real trouble," he finished, looking at Brenda. Just the coldness in his eyes was enough to frighten Janet, but she felt defiant too, having helped in a small way. It might be worth losing her job to feel like that for a minute or two.
Hannah was brushing the last sparks from her sleeve as the men left.
"Are you burnt?" Brenda said. "Let's have a look. Roll your sleeve up."
"Brenda, I don't know how to thank you," Hannah said. Janet noticed that the old woman wasn't trembling at all, though she could feel that she was herself. She took the little brush from the fire iron stand and swept up what she could of the ashes and the mess, but it was hard to manage with shaking hands.
"And I'm so grateful to you, too," Hannah went on. "I'm sorry, but I don't know who you are. It was very brave of you both."
"Janet's the bursar's secretary from Jordan," said Brenda. "She was there when they came for Alice this morning, and she came to tell me as soon as she could, and I thought we'd better warn you. Did they take anything valuable?"
"Only my tax returns and household bills and that sort of thing. I'm glad to see the back of them, frankly. The valuable things are all in the safe, but I'm going to have to move them now. Do you know, I'd love a cup of tea. How about you both?"
Next morning, Janet went into work as usual, and thought the porter gave her an odd look as she went in through the lodge. She found the bursar waiting in his office, watching for her. He called her in as soon as he heard her arrive.
"Good morning," she said carefully.
He was sitting behind his desk, playing with a piece of cardboard, tapping it on the blotter, flexing it this way and that, smoothing down a crease. He didn't look at her.
"Janet, I'm sorry, but I've got some unfortunate news," he said.
He was speaking quickly. He still didn't look at her. She felt her stomach about to sink and held her tongue.
It's been made clear to me that it would be difficult to, continue your employment," he said.
"Why?"
"It seems that you unfortunately made a bad impression on the two officers who came here yesterday. I must say, I saw nothing of that sort myself. I always valued your complete professionalism, and it may be that their attitude was a little excessive. Nevertheless, these are not easy times, and..."
"Did the master put you up to this?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"Yesterday, when he called you in there. After they'd taken Alice. What did he say to you?"
"Well, it was confidential, obviously. But he did stress the extreme difficulty we have in maintaining the independence of an institution like this, which is, after all, part of the national community and not separate from it. the pressures that bear on all of us.
His voice simply trailed away, as if he had no more strength. And to do him justice, she thought, he did look about as miserable as a man could look.
So the master tells you to sack me, and you do it? No, no, it wasn't. This came from a different source. A far more, how shall I say, authoritative. It used to be the master who had authority in the college. I don't think the old master would have put up with being told what to do by someone else. Janet, you're not making this very easy. I don't want to make it easy. I want to know why I'm to be dismissed after doing my job well for 12 years. You've never had a complaint about me, have you? Well, not as such, but it seems that, yesterday, you did interfere with some important men in the execution of their duty. Not here, though. Not in college. Did I interfere yesterday when they were here? It doesn't matter where. I'd have thought it mattered quite a lot. Did they tell you what they were doing? I didn't speak to them directly. Well, I'll tell you. They were stealing the property of an old lady and treating her brutally. And I happened to see it going on, and me and my friend stepped in and helped her. And that's all, Mr. Stringer, that's all that happened. Is this the kind of country we're living in now? That people can be sacked from jobs they do well just because they inconvenience bullies and thugs from the CCD? Is that the kind of place this is?
The bursar put his head in his hands. Janet had never in her life spoken to an employer like that, and she stood with fast-beating heart while he sighed heavily and 3 times tried to say something.
"It's very difficult," he said.
He looked up, but not at her.
"There are things I can't explain. Pressures and tensions that, college staff, domestic staff, are quite properly protected from. These are times unlike any. I have to protect the staff from..."
She said nothing, as his words faded into silence.
"Well, if you've got to get rid of me," she said finally, "why did they arrest Alice? And what have they done with her? Where is she now?"
All he could do was sigh and lower his head. She began to gather her own few possessions from the desk where she worked.
She felt light-headed, as if part of her was somewhere else and dreaming of this, and she'd wake up soon and find everything normal.
Then she went into his office again. He looked utterly diminished.
"If you can't tell me where she is as an employer," she said, "can you tell me as a friend? She is my friend. She's everyone's friend. She's part of the college. She's been here ages, much longer than me. Please, Mr. Stringer, where have they taken her?"
He was pretending he couldn't hear her. His face was turned down. He sat perfectly still. He was pretending she wasn't there, and that no one was asking him questions. And he seemed to think that if he sat still and didn't look at her, what he pretended would come true. She felt a little sick. She put her things in a shopping bag and left. Several hours later, Alice was sitting, her ankles shackled, in a closed railway carriage with 12 other figures similarly restrained. Some of them had swollen eyes and lips, bloody noses, bruised cheekbones. The youngest was a boy of 11 or so, chalk-pale and wide-eyed with fear. The oldest, a man of Hannah's age, gaunt and trembling. 2 dim ambaric bulbs, one at each end of the carriage, provided the only light. As an ingenious extra way of keeping the prisoners still, cages of some bright metal covered in silvery mesh were attached underneath the hard benches that ran the length of the carriage, and each prisoner's demon was locked in one of them. There was little conversation. Their guards had thrown them roughly inside, manhandled their demons into the cages, slapped the shackles on their ankles, and told them nothing. The carriage had been in a siding in the empty countryside when the prisoners had been brought there, and a locomotive had arrived after an hour or so to pull the carriage. Somewhere. The young boy was sitting opposite Alice. After they had been moving for 30 minutes, he began to fidget, and Alice said, "You all right, love?"
the toilet, he said in a whisper. Alice looked up and down the carriage. The doors had been locked at each end. They'd all heard the sound and seen the large keys, and there was no lavatory, and she knew full well that no one would come if they called. Stand up and turn around and do it behind the bench, she said. No one will blame you. It's their fault, not yours. He tried to do as she said, but it was too hard to turn around with his ankles shackled. He had to urinate on the floor in front. Alice looked away till he'd finished. He was bitterly ashamed. "What's your name, love?" she said. "Anthony." She could hardly hear him. "You stick to me," she said. "We'll help each other. I'm Alice. Don't worry about peeing on the floor, but we'll all be doing it in the end. Where'd you live?" They began to talk, and the train moved on into the night. Chapter 31 Little Stick. The noises of shouting voices, heavy boots on concrete, the trundle of iron wheels as a large trolley went past the train window laden with what looked like boxes of ammunition, all combined with the violent hiss of steam, filled the air and made Lyra listen hard for a language she recognized, or a voice that wasn't harsh and commanding. There was loud male laughter, too, and more shouted orders. Men in desert camouflage uniforms were staring in at her and making remarks about her and then moving past towards the door of the carriage. Invisible, she thought. Dowdy. Undesirable. The compartment door slid open with a bang. A soldier looked in and said something in Turkish, in reply to which she could only shake her head and shrug. He said something to the other men behind him and came in, heaving his heavy pack up onto the rack and unslinging the rifle he was carrying. Four others joined him, jostling, laughing, staring at her, treading on one another's feet. She kept her own feet out of the way and made herself as small as possible. The soldiers' demons were all dogs, fierce ones, shoving each other and snarling. And then one of them stopped and stared at her with sudden interest, and threw her head back and howled with fear. Every other sound stopped. The demon soldier bent to stroke her in reassurance, but the others had all registered what had caused the howling, and began to howl too. A soldier snapped at Lyra, asking a question fierce and hostile. Then a sergeant appeared at the door, evidently demanding to know what was happening, at which the soldier with the first howling demon pointed at Lyra and said something with an air of superstitious hatred. The sergeant barked a question at her, but he too was frightened. In answer she said,
"J'aime le son du corps, le soir, au fond des bois."
It was the first thing that came to mind, a line of French poetry. The men stood perfectly still, waiting for a cue, waiting for the sergeant to indicate what the proper response should be, and all, by the look of them, full of dread. Lyra spoke again.
"Dieu! Que le son de corps est triste, au fond des bois!"
"Française?" said the sergeant hoarsely.
The eyes of every man and demon were on her. She nodded, then held up her hands as if to say, "I surrender, don't shoot." There must have been something in the contrast between their big, male, healthy power, the weapons they carried, the snarling teeth of their demons, and this demonless, dowdy, timid girl with the dull clothes and the glasses, something comic. Because first the sergeant smiled, and then began to laugh. And then the others, responding, saw the contrast too and joined in the laughter. And Lyra smiled and shrugged, and moved up a little more to make room. The sergeant said again,
"Française!" and added, "Voilà!"
The only soldier apparently willing to sit next to her was a heavily built, dark-skinned, big-eyed man with an air of being able to enjoy things. He said something to her in a friendly enough tone, and she replied with more French poetry.
"La nature est un temple où de vivants piliers laisse parfois sortir de confuses paroles."
"Ah,"
he said, nodding confidently. Then the sergeant spoke to them all, giving orders, looking at her a couple of times as if the orders included instructions about how to behave towards her. With a final look at her and a nod, he left,
and went to push his way through the other soldiers still crowding onto the train. It took several minutes to get them all on board, and Lyra wondered how many of them there were, and where the officer in charge was. She soon found that out, because obviously prompted by the sergeant, a tall young man in a smarter uniform than the rest looked in at the compartment door and spoke to her.
"You are French, mademoiselle," he said, in careful and strongly accented French.
"Yes," she said in the same language.
"Where are you travelling to?"
"Seleukia, monsieur."
"Why you have not,
He clearly didn't know the French word, and indicated his own hawk demon, who was clutching his epaulet and staring with yellow eyes.
"He disappeared," she said. "I am looking for him." "It is not possible."
"But it is. It happened. You can see."
"You are going to look in Seleukia?"
"Everywhere. I will search everywhere." He gave a baffled nod. He seemed to want to know more, or to forbid something, or require something, but not to know what. He looked around at the soldiers in the compartment, and then withdrew. More men were passing along the corridor. Doors were slamming. A voice called on the platform, and a guard blew a whistle. The train began to move. Once they were out of the station, and leaving the lights of the town for the darkness of the mountains again, the soldier nearest the door leaned out and looked both ways along the corridor. Evidently satisfied, he nodded to the man opposite, who produced a bottle from his pack and pulled out the cork. Lyra smelled a tang of powerful spirits, and remembered another occasion when she'd had the same sensation. Outside Einarsson's bar in the Arctic town of Trollesund, seeing the great bear Yorick Bernason drinking spirits from an earthenware jug. If only she had his company on this journey, or the company of Father Coram, who'd been with her then. The bottle was being passed around. When it reached the man next to her, he took a deep pull, and then breathed out loudly, filling the air with fumes. The man opposite waved them away in mock disgust before taking the bottle himself. Then he hesitated, looked at Lyra with a knowing smile, and offered it to her. She smiled back briefly, and shook her head. The soldier said something, and offered it again more forcefully, as if daring her to refuse. Another man spoke to him, apparently criticizing. The soldier took a pull at the spirits, and said something hard and unfriendly to Lyra, before passing the bottle on. She tried to become invisible, but made sure her stick was just inside the rucksack. The bottle went around the compartment again. The talk became louder and looser. They were talking about her, there was no doubt about that. Their eyes moved over her body. One man was licking his lips, another clasping the crotch of his trousers. Lyra gathered the rucksack to herself with her left arm and began to stand up, intending to leave, only for the man opposite to push her back into the seat and say something to the man by the door, who reached up and pulled down the blind over the corridor window. Lyra stood up again, and again the soldier pushed her back, this time squeezing her breast as he did. She felt a flood of dread invading her bloodstream. "Well," she thought, "here it comes." She stood up a third time, her right hand grasping the handle of her stick, Pequeno. And when the soldier's hand came forward, she whipped the stick out of the rucksack and smashed it down so hard that she heard the crack of bone a moment before he yelled in pain. His demon leaped up at her, and she lashed the stick across her dog face, sending her howling to the floor. The man was cradling his broken hand, white-faced, unable to speak or utter a sound except a high, tremulous whimper. She felt another man's hands on her waist, and gripped the stick tight and swung it backwards, luckily hitting him on the temple with the end of the handle. He shouted, and tried to grab her arm, so she twisted round and sank her teeth into his hand, feeling a flame of pure ferocity blaze up in her heart. She drew blood, she bit deeper, a length of skin came away in her teeth, and his hand fell off her arm. His face loomed close, insensate with fury. She stabbed the stick up into the soft flesh under his jaw, and as he reared up and away from that, she lashed it harder than she'd hit anything else in her life, across his nose and mouth.
He grunted and fell back, gushing blood, and then his demon too was leaping for Lyra's throat. She brought up a knee as hard as she could, knocking the demon aside, and then felt other hands, two men's hands, on her wrist, up inside her skirt, fumbling at her underwear, gripping it, tearing it aside and thrusting fingers at her, and other hands on the stick, twisting it, tearing it out of her fingers, and then with feet, teeth, forehead, knees, she fought as she had seen Yorick Burnison fight, reckless, heedless of pain, fearless, but she was outnumbered. Even in the crowded little compartment, they had more room, more strength, just more hands and feet than she did, and they had demons, who were now growling, roaring, barking with fury, teeth bared, spittle flying, and still she fought and struggled, and it was the noise from the demons that saved her, because suddenly the door was flung open, and there was the sergeant, who took it all in at once, and said a word to his demon, a massive brute, who tore at the soldiers' demons, teeth in their necks, flinging them aside as if they weighed nothing, and the men fell back on the seats, bloodied and broken-boned, and Lyra was still standing, her skirt torn, her fingers blood-soaked and wrenched. Her face cut and scratched, blood trickling down her legs, her eyes aflood with tears, trembling in every muscle, sobbing, but standing, still standing, facing them all. She pointed to the man who had her stick. She had to support her right hand with her left wrist to do it. "Give it to me," she said. "Give it back to me." Her voice was thick with tears, and shaking so much she could hardly articulate the words. The man tried to shove the stick down beside him on the seat. With the last of her strength, she flung herself at him, and tore at his face, his hands, with nails and teeth and fury, but found herself lifted away effortlessly, and held up in the air by the sergeant's left arm. He snapped the fingers of his right hand at the soldier, whose eyes and nose were now bleeding thickly. The man handed up the stick. The sergeant put it in his pocket, and then barked an order. Another soldier picked up Lyra's rucksack and handed it to him. Another harsh sentence or two, and he carried the struggling Lyra out into the corridor and put her down. He jerked his head, indicating that she should follow him, although she could barely stand. And then he shoved his way forcefully through the men who had come out into the corridor to see what was going on. Lyra had to go with him. He had the rucksack and the stick. Shaking so violently, she almost lost her balance, feeling the blood trickling past her mouth and the wetness on her legs. She did her best to follow. Every soldier's eyes were staring, taking in every detail, greedy to know more. She stumbled through the midst of them, trying to hold herself steady. Simply that. Once the train lurched over a poor section of track and she almost fell, but a hand came out to hold her upright. She pulled her arm away and moved on. The sergeant was waiting outside the last compartment in the next carriage. Standing in the doorway was the officer, major, captain, whatever he was. And as she reached him, the sergeant handed her the rucksack, which had never seemed so heavy. "Thank you," she managed to say in French. "And my stick." The officer asked the sergeant something. The sergeant took the stick out of his pocket and gave it to the officer, who looked at it curiously. The sergeant was explaining what had happened. "My stick," Lyra said, steadying her voice as much as she could. "Are you going to leave me entirely defenseless? Let me have it back." "You have already put three of my men out of action, I am told." "Am I supposed to let myself be raped? I'd kill them all first." She had never felt so ferocious and so weak. She was really on the point of falling to the floor, and at the same time, she was ready to tear out his throat to get her stick back. The sergeant said something. The officer replied and nodded, and reluctantly handed Lyra back the stick. She tried to open her rucksack and failed, and tried again and failed, and began to cry to her immense anger. The officer stood aside and indicated the seat behind him. The compartment was empty, apart from his valise, a multitude of papers spread out on the opposite seat, and a half-finished meal of bread and cold meat. Lyra sat down, and tried a third time to open her rucksack. This time she managed,
though it made her realize how damaged her fingers were. Torn nails, swollen joints, a wrenched thumb. She wiped her eyes with the heel of her left hand, took several deep breaths, gritted her teeth, at which point she found one of them broken, and explored it with her tongue. Half of it was missing. Too bad, she thought. She gathered her resolution and worked at the rucksack buckles with her painful fingers. Her left hand was so sore and weak and swollen, she touched the back of it tenderly and thought she felt a broken bone. Finally, she got the rucksack open and found the alethiometer, the pack of cards, and her little purse of money. She slipped the stick down inside and buckled it again, and then leaned back and closed her eyes. Every part of her seemed to hurt. She could still feel those hands tearing at her underclothes and wanted to wash more than anything else in the world. Oh, Pan, she thought. Are you satisfied now? The officer had been speaking quietly to the sergeant. She heard him reply and then move away, and the officer came back into the compartment and slid the door shut. Are you in pain? He said. She opened her eyes. One of them seemed to prefer to stay closed. She touched the flesh around it with her right hand. It was already swollen. She looked at the young man. It wasn't really necessary to say anything. She held out her trembling hands to show him the damage. If you will permit me, he said. He sat down opposite and opened a little cloth-bound case. His hawk demon jumped down and looked through as he moved the contents around. Rolls of bandage, a little pot of salve, bottles of pills, small envelopes probably containing powders of one sort or another. He unfolded a clean cloth and uncapped a brown bottle to sprinkle some liquid on it. Rose water, he said. He handed it to her and indicated that she might clean her face with it. It was marvelously cool and soothing, and she held it over her eyes until she felt able to look at him again. She lowered the cloth, and he sprinkled it with more rose water. I thought rose water was difficult to obtain, she said. Not for officers. I see. Well, thank you. There was a mirror over the seat opposite, and she stood up shakily and looked at herself, almost recoiling when she saw the mess of blood over her mouth and nose. Her right eye was nearly closed. Invisible, she thought bitterly, and set to work cleaning herself. More applications of rose water helped, and so did the salve in the little pot, stinging at first, and then diffusing a deep warmth, along with a strong herbal smell. Finally she sat down and took a deep breath. It was her left hand, she thought, that hurt the most. She touched it tentatively again. The officer was watching. I may? He said, and took the hand with great gentleness. His own hands were soft and silky. He moved it to and fro, just a little this way and that, but it hurt her too much to let him continue. Possibly a broken bone, he said. Well, if you will ride on a train with soldiers, you must expect a little discomfort. I have a ticket that permits me to ride on this train. It does not say that the journey includes assault and attempted rape. Do you expect your soldiers to behave like that? No, and they will be punished. But, I repeat, it is not wise for a young woman to travel alone in the present circumstances. May I offer you a little eau de vie as a restorative? She nodded. That hurt her head. He poured the spirit into a little metal cup, and she sipped it carefully. It tasted like the best brandy wine. When does the train arrive in Seleucia? She said. In 2 hours. She closed her eyes. Hugging the rucksack close to her breast, she let herself sink into a doze. Only a few seconds later, it seemed, the officer was squeezing her shoulder. Her heavy consciousness was reluctant to leave the slumber behind. She wanted to sleep for a month. But outside the window, she could see the lights of a city, and the train was slowing down. The officer was gathering his papers together, and then he looked up as the door slid open. The sergeant said something, perhaps reporting that the men were ready to leave the train. He looked at Lyra, as if assessing the damage. She looked down,
Time to be modest again. Inconspicuous. Dowdy. But inconspicuous, she thought, with a black eye and a broken hand and cuts and scratches all over. And no demon.
"Mademoiselle," said the officer.
She looked up and saw the sergeant was holding something out to her. It was her spectacles, with one lens broken and one arm missing. She took them without a word.
"Come with me," said the officer, "and I shall help you leave the train first."
She didn't argue. She stood up, with some difficulty and pain, and he helped her lift the rucksack to her shoulders. The sergeant stood aside to let them out of the compartment. All along the train, as far as she could tell, soldiers were gathering their weapons and possessions and shoving their way into the corridor, but the officer called out, and the nearest ones moved back out of the way as Lyra followed him towards the door.
"A little advice," he said, as he helped her stiffly down onto the platform.
"Well?"
"Wear a niqab," he said. "It will help."
"I see. Thank you. It would be better for everyone if you disciplined your soldiers."
"You have done that yourself."
"I should not have had to."
"Nevertheless, you defended yourself. They will think twice before behaving badly again."
"No, they won't. You know that."
"You are probably right. They are trash. Seleucia is a difficult city. Do not stay here long. There will be more soldiers arriving by other trains. Better move on soon."
Then he turned away and left her alone. His men watched her from the train windows as she limped along the platform towards the ticket hall. She had no idea what she could do next.
Chapter 32. Hospitality.
She walked away from the station and tried to look as if she had every right to be there and knew where she was going. Every part of her body hurt. Every part felt tainted by the hands that had thrust their way to her flesh. Her rucksack was a hideous burden. How had it become so heavy? She longed for sleep. It was the dead of night. The streets were empty of people, poorly lit and hard. There were no trees, no bushes, no grass, no little parks or squares with a patch of greenery, nothing but hard pavements and stone-built warehouses or banks or office buildings. Nowhere to lay her head. The place felt so quiet, she thought, that there must be a curfew, and that if she were found wandering, she would be arrested. She almost longed for that. She could sleep in a cell. There was no sign of a hotel, not even a single cafe, nowhere that might be intended for the refreshment or repose of travelers. This place made an outcast of every visitor. Only once did she hear any sign of life, and that was when, nearly crazed with exhaustion and at the limit of pain and unhappiness, she risked knocking at a door. Her intention was to throw herself on the mercy of whoever lived there, in the hope that their culture had a tradition of hospitality to strangers, in the face of all the evidence to the contrary. The timid knock with bruised knuckles awoke only a man, clearly a night watchman or security guard of some kind, on duty just inside. His demon woke him with a frenzy of howling, and he snarled a curse at whoever had dared to knock. His voice was full of hate and fear. Lyra hurried away. She could hear him cursing and shouting for a long time. Finally, she could go no further. She simply crumpled at a spot shaded from the glare of the nearest streetlight by the corner of a building, and curled up around the rucksack and fell asleep. She was too hurt and tired even to sob. The tears flowed from her eyes with no impulsion. She felt them cold on her cheek, her eyelids, her temple, and did nothing to staunch them. And then she was asleep. Someone was shaking her shoulder. A low voice was whispering anxious, urgent words that she couldn't understand. Everything hurt. It was still dark. When she opened her eyes, there was no light to dazzle her. The man leaning over her was dark too, a deeper darkness, and he stank terribly. There was another figure nearby. She could see his face, pale against the night, looking this way and that.
The first man stood back as she struggled to sit up on the cold stone and to loosen her limbs a little. It was so cold. They had a cart and a long-handled shovel. More words in that urgent low voice. They were gesturing. Get up, stand, get up. The stench was sickening. As she painfully moved her limbs and forced herself up, she understood. These were night soil men, making their round, emptying the city's latrines and cesspits, an occupation for the lowest and most despised class of people. She tried French.
What do you want? I am lost. Where are we?
But they could only speak their own language, which sounded neither Anatolian nor Arabic. At any rate, she couldn't understand, except to see that they were anxious, and anxious for her. But she was so cold, so full of pain. She tried to stop shivering. The first man said something else, which seemed to be, "Follow. Come with us." Even burdened with their stinking cart, they moved faster than she could, and she caught some of their anxiety when they had to slow down for her. They kept looking all around. Finally, they came to an alley between two imposing stone buildings and turned into it. There was just the very faintest hint in the sky that the night was going. Nothing as much as light, just a slight dilution of the dark. She understood. They had to finish their round by daylight, and they wanted her out of sight before then. The alley was very narrow, and the buildings crowded close above. She was getting used to the smell. No, she wasn't. She never would. But it was no worse than it had been. One of the men lifted the latch on a low door and opened it quietly. Instantly, a female voice inside, heavy with sleep but awake at once, uttered a short, fear-filled question. The man replied, equally briefly, and stood aside to indicate Lyra. A woman's face emerged dimly from the gloom, strained, fearful, prematurely aged. Lyra stepped forward so as to be more clearly visible. The woman scanned her for a moment, and then reached out a hand to take hers. It was the broken hand, and Lyra couldn't help a cry of pain. The woman shrank back into the darkness, and the man spoke urgently again. "Sorry, sorry," said Lyra quietly, though she felt like howling with agony. She could feel that the hand was swollen and hot. The woman emerged a second time and beckoned, taking care not to touch. Lyra turned to express her thanks, somehow, but the men were already hastening away with their stinking cart. She stepped forward carefully, ducking under the low lintel. The woman shut the door, and total darkness enveloped them. But Lyra heard a rustling movement, and then the woman struck a match and lit the wick of a little oil lamp. The room smelled of nothing but sleep and cooked food. In the yellow glow, Lyra could see that her hostess was very thin, and that she was younger than she'd seemed. The woman indicated the bed, or rather a mattress heaped with various coverings. It was the only place to sit down apart from the floor. Lyra put her rucksack down and sat on the corner of the mattress, saying, "Thank you. It's very kind. Merci, merci." It was only then that she noticed that she hadn't seen the woman's demon, and with a little jolt, she realized that the men had no demons either. She said, "Demon?" and tried to indicate her own lack of one, but the woman clearly didn't understand, and Lyra just shook her head. There was nothing else she could do. Perhaps these poor people had to do the job they did because, without having demons, they were less than human in the eyes of their society. They were the lowest caste there was, and she belonged with them. The woman was watching her. Lyra pointed to her own breast and said, "Lyra." "Ah," said the woman, and pointed to herself, saying, "Your star." "Your star," repeated Lyra carefully. The woman said, "Lyra. Lyra. Lyra. That's it." They both smiled. "Your star" indicated that Lyra could lie down, and Lyra did. And then she felt a heavy rug being pulled up over her, and at once she fell asleep, for the third time that night. She woke up to the sound of low voices. Daylight was filtering in through a bead curtain across the doorway, but it was grey, with no direct sunshine in it.
Lyra opened her eyes to see the woman Yozdar and a man, presumably one of the two who had brought her there, sitting on the floor and eating from a large bowl between them. She lay and watched them before moving. The man looked younger than the woman, and his clothes were shabby, but she couldn't detect any of the stink from his profession. She sat up carefully, and found her left hand too painful even to open fully. The woman saw her move and said something to the man, who turned to look and then stood up. Lyra urgently needed a privy or something of the sort, and when she tried to convey this, the man looked away, and the woman understood and led her outside through another door into a little yard. The latrine was in the far corner, and meticulously clean. Yozdar was waiting in the doorway when she came out, holding a jar of water. She mimed holding out her hands, and Lyra did that, guarding her left from the shock of the cold water as best she could, when Yozdar poured it over them. She offered Lyra a thin towel and beckoned her inside. The man was still standing, waiting for her to come back, and indicated that she should sit on the carpet with them and eat from the bowl of rice. She did so, using her right hand as they did. Yozdar said to the man, "Lyra," and pointed to her.
"Lyra," he said, and pointed to himself and said, "Childu."
"Childu," Lyra said.
The rice was sticky and almost flavorless but for a little salt. Still, it was all they had, and she tried to take as little as possible, since they hadn't expected a guest. Childu and Yozdar spoke quietly to each other, and Lyra wondered what language they were speaking. It was like none that she'd heard before. But she had to try and communicate with them. She spoke to them both, turning from one to the other, and saying as clearly as she could,
"I want to find the Blue Hotel. Have you heard of the Blue Hotel? Alkan al-Azraq."
They both looked at her. He was politely mystified, and she was anxious.
"Or Madinat al-Kamar?"
They knew that. They drew back. They shook their heads. They put up their hands as if to ban any further mention of that name.
"English? Do you know anyone who speaks English?"
They didn't understand.
"Français? Quelqu'un qui parle français?"
Same response. She smiled and shrugged and ate another morsel of rice. Yozdar stood up and took a pan from the open fire and poured boiling water into two earthenware cups. Into each one she dropped a pinch of some dark, gritty-looking powder, and scooped a lump of what might have been butter or soft cheese in after it. Then she stirred each cup with a stiff brush, making both cups froth up, and gave one to Childu and the other to Lyra.
"Thank you," Lyra said, "but..."
and pointed to the cup, and then to Yozdar. That seemed to breach some point of etiquette, for Yozdar frowned and looked away, and Childu gently pushed Lyra's hand away.
"Well," said Lyra, "thank you. I expect you can use the cup when I've finished. It's very generous of you."
The drink was too hot to sip, but Childu was drinking it by sucking at the edge with a noisy splashing sound. Lyra did the same. It tasted both bitter and rancid, but inside it there was a taste not unlike tea. She found after several noisy slurpings that it was sharp and refreshing.
"It's good," she said. "Thank you. What is it called?"
She pointed to her cup and looked inquisitive.
"Choy," said Yozdar. "Ah, it is tea, then."
Childu spoke to his wife for about a minute, making suggestions, perhaps, or maybe giving instructions. She listened critically, making an interjection here, asking a question there, but finally saying something that was plainly in agreement. They both glanced at Lyra throughout. She watched, wary, listening for any words she might understand, trying to interpret their expressions. When the conversation was over, Yozdar stood up and opened a wooden chest, which looked as if it was made of cedar and was the only beautiful or costly-seeming object in the room. She took out a folded piece of cloth, black in color, and shook it out of its folds. It was surprisingly long. Yozdar looked at her and beckoned. So Lyra got up. Yozdar was refolding the cloth a different way, and indicating that Lyra should watch, so she did, trying to memorize the sequence of folds. Then Yozdar stepped behind her and began to fasten the cloth around her head, first putting one edge across the bridge of Lyra's nose so that the cloth hung over the lower part of her face, and then winding the rest around her head to conceal every part of it except her eyes. She tucked ends in on both sides. Childu was watching. He gestured at his own head, and Yozdar understood and tucked away the last strand of Lyra's coal-black hair. He said something that clearly signified approval. Lyra said, "Thank you," hearing her voice muffled. She hated it, but she could see the sense. She was impatient to be on her way, as if she knew what her way was, or where. And there was nothing to keep her here, especially since they had no language in common. So she put her palms together in what she hoped would be understood as a gesture of thanks and of farewell, and bowed her head, and picked up her rucksack, and left. She bitterly regretted having nothing to give them but money, and thought briefly of offering them a couple of coins, but feared that they'd feel she was insulting their hospitality. She made her way out of the little alley, where the night soil cart stood at one side, looking as if it was ashamed of itself. It wasn't locked to anything. Who would want to steal such an object? The street outside was dazzling with brilliant sunshine, and Lyra soon began to feel hot under the abominably confined